This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Kalamazoo Humane Society Director Aaron Winters tells us about their efforts to help get pets spayed and neutered and their plans for a new facility. But first, when a recession ends, that is supposed to bring back jobs. But workers may find the same jobs they lost in an economic downturn are not there even after the unemployment rate has bounced back. Brad Hirschbein is an economist with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo. He's also the co-author of a study for the National Bureau of Economic Research on the Great Recession and the skills required in the new job market. Brad Hirschbein, thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
So give us the thumbnail sketch here. What were you looking at in this study? What were you trying to find out?
So we began investigating, we were interested in investigating how the skills of jobs changed over the business cycle when the economy tanked during the Great Recession and as it began to recover. And this question has been investigated a little bit by previous researchers, but a limitation has always been that we couldn't actually see what was going on within specific jobs, within specific occupations. Most of what previous research had found was that there was an increase in demand for occupations that we knew generally required more skill, more training, more education. So a lot of the impact was being found across different types of jobs. But there was an unresolved question of what was happening within certain types of jobs. And so we were taking advantage of a new data product by a company, and we worked out an arrangement to get the data from them that actually looked at the requirements within job postings for specific jobs, over 80 or 90 million job postings throughout the country before and after the Great Recession. And these data allowed us to actually look what was happening not just across jobs, but within jobs and for specific companies. And we found that when the economy, well, I should say, across different areas that experienced the recession differently, we found that areas that had a worse time during the recession, those areas, the jobs posted in those areas, had larger increases in the skills required in those jobs, whether it be education or experience or computer or other types of skills. And those increases not only happened right during the recession, but they stayed elevated for several years afterward, even as the economy began to recover.
So what we're talking here about here is not necessarily like we hear the story about someone who worked in a manufacturing job, and then that job maybe gets shipped overseas or it becomes automated, and then that person has to find a different sort of job to do, which may still be in manufacturing but require more skills. What you're talking about here is this is the same job before the recession and after the recession, but after the recession, you need more skills to do it. Is that what's going on?
That's what we're finding a lot of evidence for. And because the skill requirements are staying elevated for several years afterward, even as the economy is recovering, we don't think it's just a temporary phenomenon where a whole bunch of workers lost their jobs during the recession and are now all desperately trying to get new jobs and employers are just being picky temporarily because they can. Rather, we're arguing that there's a lot of evidence suggesting that during the recession, firms are actually changing how they do and what they make, how they make what they do. And by changing the amount of machinery they have, the layout of floors, how they actually combine workers and machines. And when they actually do this process, they need more educated or more skilled workers than they did before to do the same sorts of activities. So the workers who lost their jobs, in anticipation that they might get it back, it turns out that the skills they need to do those very similar jobs have now been increased. And if they don't have those skills, that makes it more difficult for them to find those jobs.
Are employers making these changes because of market forces which are requiring it, or are they looking at a recession as an opportunity to do things differently?
Both. It's that the recession is kind of catalyzing the opportunity and the timing for when they're going to make these additional changes. We know that the pace of technology has accelerated, it's continuing, but if firms can't really constantly adjust because that's just not feasible, it's just too costly. So they wait till there's a good time to do it when demand for whatever it is that they're producing is low, generally during a recession, and that's when they decide basically to clean house. They are letting go of a lot of their workers, generally ones that they think of are not going to be as productive once they actually increase their technology, adopt those new software programs, or whatever it is going to be.
So this is a term that people have used. They've called it upskilled, that the job becomes upskilled, that it now requires more training, different types of skills than were required before. Are there certain types of jobs that you found where this was more likely to happen?
So that's another advantage of the data that we were using is that it allowed us to look across different types of occupations and across different types of firms. And we found that the prevalence of this upskilling was pretty widespread across a large variety of different types of jobs, including many in the middle, but as well as several high-end jobs, things that we think of normally also require a fair amount of training and experience. Even jobs that are in the top quarter of how much they pay, those jobs also increased their demand for certain types of skills. So it was pretty widespread. One thing that we were finding is that the jobs, generally the least skilled jobs near the bottom, those are the ones that were slightly more likely to have a temporary effect, where it was the firms kind of trying to take advantage of an extra bunch of workers who were desperate. Those effects went down a little bit, but for the rest of the jobs, the majority of them, it stayed elevated for several years afterwards.
Are some of these jobs ones that would probably be done by someone with a college degree?
In some cases, yes. So we found that there was an increase in the likelihood of any education or experience requirement showing up in the posting. But we also found that if we looked at the specific credential, for example, there was an increase both in whether a high school degree would be required as well as whether a bachelor's degree would be required. For jobs that typically require a bachelor's degree even beforehand, we didn't find quite as much evidence of increases in, say, a graduate degree.
You also have this broken down somewhat by geography. Are there some things that you can say about the types of cities or metropolitan areas that are more likely to be hard hit by these changes?
Right. So we were basically saying that different areas were hit differently by the recession for reasons that had little to do with pre-existing trends and what was going on in upskilling. And that's kind of how we're making the inference that we do in the paper. And we go to at length to show that is in fact the case. But certain areas that were badly hit, it turns out that Grand Rapids was actually a more badly hit MSA or metropolitan area. And that may surprise a lot of people because Grand Rapids didn't suffer all that much relative to some other cities or areas that we can think of. And that's because we weren't necessarily using the overall level of how bad things got, but by how much it changed. And before the recession, Grand Rapids was doing very well. So even though it fell quite a bit and still remained better off than some other areas, that decrease in its economic conditions was enough to make it one of the more negatively affected metro areas.
Are we also here in your case, in your study, are you perhaps looking a little more at what this means for individual workers? As opposed to maybe the overall blanket economy, which may show one thing in an unemployment rate, are you looking at something different in terms of what workers are able to come back to jobs or have to find new ones?
Right. So one of the inferences that we can draw, the conclusions, is that if every area had been as badly affected as the really badly affected areas were, then of the 5.5 million vacancies, roughly speaking, out there right now, nearly 250,000 of them would have additional job requirements that they otherwise would not have. So for those types of workers who would normally be able to get a job without those additional requirements, it becomes more difficult. And one of the things that we have wondered, economists, over the past three recessions going back to the early 90s, is that each successive recovery in terms of the labor market is taking longer and longer for people to return to the labor market. And there are a lot of people who spend very long periods of time unemployed. One of the reasons for that that comes out of our paper might be that because they were let go during a time when firms were actually upskilling, the workers who were let go, if they didn't have those new sets of skills, then they had much greater difficulty of finding a job. And until they get those skills, they may also continue to have difficulty finding a job. So it's a mechanism for why that there's a jobless recovery. And there's a need for us to try to address these workers' concerns and give them sorts of skills or training, preferably before they even lose their job, to mitigate their circumstances.
One thing you hear when you work at a university is that a lot of people will go back to school when they have lost a job or perhaps when they're fearing that they might lose a job. Do you think that your study tells us that this needs to be more of an ongoing concern for workers and also for companies?
I think it certainly points in that direction. There's one sign among many, and I think that our paper is a pretty important one, that the need for increased training and an ongoing sense of lifelong learning is not just something that doctors and lawyers and other occupations that need to periodically get recertified, it's not just for them anymore. That people need to keep their skills up to date. And as a matter of public policy, we need to figure out how to make that happen for people who can't afford to do it on their own. And that's actually a good chunk of them.
Well, and that brings up an interesting point, because we hear a lot about worker training and retraining. But if you're talking about someone who is currently working a 40-hour a week job, and maybe more than that, they also have other responsibilities, family, et cetera. What sort of allowances could you make in public policy that might allow somebody to continue working and at the same time maybe get ready for the next job?
That's a very good question. I think it's generally in businesses' interest to try to promote increases in skill for their incumbent workforce, because there are a lot of costs of trying to find new workers with these new skills, and a lot of businesses spend an inordinate amount of time and money searching for the workers with those skills. And in fact, they complain often that they can't find them. So I think that there's a solution to be had with greater partnerships between businesses and local institutions of higher education, both community colleges and universities, to develop the programs that keep the workforces, their skills, up to date in ways that are good for the workers, for the businesses, and for the local economy.
But I'm also wondering if your study shows that when they do go looking for these workers with more skills, that they're finding them. I mean, does it seem to be that they are able to find
people? We do find limited evidence for that in the paper. There is some evidence. It's not quite a slam dunk, but it's suggestive that yes, after the increases in the demand for these skills appeared in the job ads, we do see that reflected in actual workers that are employed. And this was most prevalently shown in the reduction of people who are high school dropouts had a much harder time of finding a job than people with higher levels of education. And that stayed, again, for several years, even after the recovery.
What do you think this says to somebody who is currently in the workforce? If they're reading your study or maybe hearing this interview, what do you think is a takeaway that someone might have based on what you are saying about the changes in skills that might come about during an economic downturn?
I think that if people think that their job is secure, and again, not everyone does, I think there's greater awareness that job security is not what it used to be, but to be more proactive about it, and to the extent that you can, and be aware of other trends that are going on in your occupation, in your industry, of what skills are needed of people who are coming on, and try to explore ways in which you can develop those skills. And in some cases, that means actually talking to your employer or talking to other local organizations, maybe the community college, browsing what programs they have, but generally not being complacent and thinking that I have a decent job that pays me well, reasonably well now, and I expect to keep it. That security is only there to the next recession, if then.
Looking ahead, everyone always worries that there's going to be some new technological advancement which perhaps makes their job obsolete, or perhaps does part of their job that they're doing now, which seems valuable, and now that's no longer there. Is the next downturn in the economy, and we know economies are cyclical and they always hit some sort of a downturn, is that likely to advance this phenomenon even more?
Yes, I think so. One of the things that we actually look at in the paper is that the specific firms that increased skilling, upskilled the most in badly hit areas were also the same firms that increased their amount of capital, which we were using as an argument that they were having increases in technology as well, possibly along the lines that you were suggesting. So it's a difficult question. I'm not sure, but I can say this, that one of the things that most people are talking about in terms of an occupation that is most likely to be automated is with self-driving cars. Truck drivers may be something that's obsolete in so many years, but I can say currently, job postings for truck drivers is one of the largest occupations out there right now. So the demand for truck drivers or people who could be truck drivers is very, very high, even though many people think that's going to be something that can be automated away. So we should continue to monitor things carefully and be aware, but I wouldn't place any bets just now on certain occupations being automated away. It tends to be a lot more complicated than people think of any given machinery or technology completely automating away an occupation.
But if we're going to think about that example for just a moment, the trucking industry, if you are currently a truck driver, if you are currently someone who runs a company which relies on the trucking industry, or if you're someone who actually owns a company which ships things via truck, what sort of things might you have, and maybe not necessarily that you're doing today, but they're in the back of your mind in terms of preparing for the day when maybe we will have self-driving trucks and we won't need truck drivers?
Yes. At the same time, if I were a 20-year-old planning on having a 40-year career in truck driving, I'd be really nervous. And I would be looking at other skills and making sure that I had a backup plan. So I think it's hard to understand what the pace of this is going to be. It's very difficult to forecast out 10 years, let alone 20 or 30. But yes, I think it's important to pay attention to what are the demands of the labor market. And fortunately, there are more ways than ever to keep up to date with that. Many actually community organizations and even schools, colleges and universities post information publicly, as does the federal government, about which occupations they expect are experiencing the largest growth, which skill sets seem to have the greatest rewards. And as we have more information that's being shared between educational institutions and state departments of workforce development, we're beginning to understand better which occupations, which programs, I should say, which educational programs are leading towards more secure economic returns.
But you also have to take all of that with a grain of salt, that we don't know what the next big thing is coming, and that what looks like a very good profession to get into right now, maybe in 5 or 10 years, doesn't look the same.
Right. I mean, the takeaway is that we should continually monitor things. You can't just look around and say, this skill is in demand right now. I'm going to invest and get a credential in that skill, and I'm going to be set for the next 30 years. That's not how it works. We need to be investing in what skills are likely to have a payoff in the short term, but we need to be monitoring those and paying attention to how the economy is changing, and have the wherewithal, I hope, to continue to invest in skills continuously, or at least frequently. And that, I think, is the big public policy question, is that our educational institutions, especially once we're already working, aren't really set up to deal with that. And that's increasingly going to be the reality.
Brad Hirschbein, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Brad Hirschbein is an economist with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo. Links to the study that he co-authored on the Great Recession and upskilling can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Kalamazoo Humane Society is hoping to prevent more unwanted pets in the Kalamazoo area. Operation Fix-It was launched in 2002. It continues again this year. Aaron Winters is executive director of the Kalamazoo Humane Society. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Explain, what is Operation Fix-It?
Well, it's a unique program. It's a low-cost spay-neuter program that we developed back in 2002. What it does is offers people that have challenges getting their animals spayed or neutered due to costs. It allows them to get their animals spayed or neutered at a reduced rate. And that's the main focus of the program, and it's open to really anybody that wants to drive to our location.
How big a problem is there with unwanted pets in the Kalamazoo area?
Well, certainly not as big as it was in 2002 when we started the program, but still there's a large problem. The shelter is nearly full many times during the year because of the number of animals that people had that had a litter of kittens and puppies that they couldn't find homes for. And it was so bad in 2002 when we really started this program, they were getting over 5,200 animals in the shelter, and a huge percentage of those animals were not finding homes, and they were being euthanized or destroyed. Though we've got that number down by 3,000, there's still a number of animals that come into the shelter that don't get homes. These animals, when people don't want them and they let them roam, they quite often are picked up by somebody else, and then they're eventually end up at the shelter. And many times they're hard to adopt, and sometimes then again they have to be euthanized. So most every community has these problems. We have less of it than some of our neighboring communities because this program's been in place.
And when we say shelter here, the Kalamazoo Humane Society itself does not operate a shelter.
Correct? No, the Kalamazoo Humane Society does not. We work closely with Kalamazoo County Animal Services Enforcement, which is on Lake Street. That is the only public county government-run shelter. There's a couple private shelters as well in our community. That's another evidence of the issue is we have a number of rescues, a number of shelters that have come about since we even started this program because of the need to find excess animals homes.
If somebody's hearing this interview and they say, yes, I have a dog, I have a cat, I haven't gotten them spayed or neutered, it's a bit of a cost, what should they do? Who do they get in touch with to talk about this?
Well, one of the easiest ways, they can log on to our website at kazoohumane.org. We have a place in there where they literally can give us their name and information and prepay to have their animals spayed or neutered, which is $40 for cats, $80 for dogs. And once they prepaid, that information, of course, comes back to our office staff, and we call them up and we set an appointment, which could be as soon as the same week, depending on our scheduling, or in some cases when we're busy, it could be a few weeks out. But that's the easiest way if people want to call us. Some people actually just come in the front door and give their information and pay at the counter. We really try to make it easy for people. You can do it in your jammies at midnight, or you can just come in the office during business hours.
You mentioned there's a reduced cost. How big of a break can someone get on spaying or neutering a dog or cat?
It's probably about one-third to one-fourth of what a standard fee would be. Some cases more if the animal has a unique health issue, whether it's an advanced pregnancy, it's what you call a crypt organ surgery, where it's there's more in-depth surgery in doing the male neuter operations. Some of those can, even the very large animals, can easily go in the $400 and $500 range. In our case, it's $80. We want to make it affordable. We want those people to have access to that. And since many cases they're not getting that access, these animals have the capability of breeding, and unneutered animals out in the community could be causing property damage or other things just because of the hormones and such that may cause some behavioral issues.
I'm wondering if that problem that you mentioned there has the potential to also snowball here. I mean, if you have stray dogs and cats wandering around and they have not been spayed or neutered.
Certainly.
I mean, we could be looking at a multiplication effect, right?
We've gone into homes before where somebody took in just a couple of cats because they were hanging around. And a few months later, because they had them in their garage, I've gone in and they've had maybe 60 or 70 animals that were interbreeding that really didn't have a lot of social contact other than the owner throwing, in one case, chicken stock and oatmeal in big pans into the garage. And so that only took a few months to go from a male and a female cat to 50 or 60. It's a little bit slower in some cases for dogs, but it gets out of hand right away. And if it's costly for you to care for two animals, now you have 30 or 40. Most people couldn't even afford the spay and neuter fees for a few. And when you get 30 or 40, it gets to be really challenging, though we've helped many a different group and individuals with large numbers of spays or neuters. It just gets out of hand really quick.
You mentioned that the problem of unwanted pets is not nearly what it was back in 2002. Can you give us some idea, you know, figures, data that show the success of Operation Fix-It?
Well, 2002, and we have, you know, there's a lot of statistics, but roughly around 5,300 animals entered in the shelter. And then in 2015, we had 2,200 or 2,300, so roughly a 3,000 animal reduction. Of that number, to get you an idea of the number of animals that dropped as far as those being destroyed because nobody wanted them, lack of space, other reasons, there were 2,500 fewer animals that were put down. So actually, we had a 78% reduction. It plays out for dogs about 75% and cats about 50% if you look at that as far as those entering the shelter and those being destroyed. When you magnify that times holding an animal with maybe $20 to $25 or $30 per day, it's not only less animals to care for and more animals getting homes, but even as a taxpayer, there's fewer dollars being spent on that. And when you have too many animals, of course, you're spending your money on picking up, just going out and retrieving them and bringing them back to shelter and housing them. It's really hard to really focus on, you know, finding them homes and doing other preventative acts. That's why we stepped in and said, you do the sheltering aspect, we'll work on the prevention spay-neuter aspect, and we'll work together to get this problem knocked down. And as spay-neuter's gone up, the intakes and euthanasia rate's gone down.
And that's the reason the Kalamazoo Humane Society does not have a shelter. They did for many years, but the decision was made years ago that the focus was going to be on prevention, correct?
It was, like many facilities back in, you know, we started in 1897, but we started sheltering in 1936. And we had two shelters between 36 and 1948. Well, in 1947, the first shelter burned, and then we built the Stadium Drive shelter, which went until 1979. But really the major function of the shelters back then were picking up and holding animals so they weren't harming people or harming livestock. We decided since for 50 or 60 years, you know, spay and neutering wasn't our holding and destroying animals wasn't making a difference. We turned to the prevention route, which was spay and neutering and humane education. And that's where we've seen the greatest difference in reduction of homeless animals when we made that switch. And then when we started Operation Fix It, it really magnified that. And we've really seen the changes in leaps and bounds since 2002.
Do you set a goal in any way for saying we'd like to spay and neuter so many pets?
We do. We set a monthly goal. We set a goal of number of cats and number of dogs. And ideally, in a perfect month, between 450 to 600 surgeries would be ideal for our location. Sometimes it goes up and down. We've depending on the number of animals in some months, we've had anywhere from 300 and a big month, 900 would be our biggest month, or 92 surgeries in one day was our biggest day. And that's operating in a very small building.
Yes, let's talk about that. Explain it to people where you are right now, the Kalamazoo Humane Society.
We're on Southwest Needs, and we're just about a quarter mile north of I-94. Most people know landmarks like Theo and Stacy's Restaurant, Outback Steakhouse. We're right there on West Needs. We bought a building in end of 97 that was built as a bridal shop. So we took that bridal shop over, and eventually it was a business office and a humane education center. And then over the years, we actually have converted it into a spay-neuter clinic. So we pushed staff to the second floor and into the lobby, and we took all the dressing rooms and other areas and created holding facilities and surgery rooms. And that's where we can do up to 7,000 surgeries a year in the area where they were hemming dresses and steaming dresses and having different fitting rooms. Now we've got kittens and puppies and dogs in those areas. But it's really not designed for that, and it's a really a difficult space to utilize when you go from 4 employees to now 16 employees and multiple volunteers that work in this small space.
And you are looking to move.
We are definitely looking to move. If anybody drives by our office now, they see this for sale sign, business relocating. Well, we do hope to relocate soon to a temporary location. But we haven't made this public yet. We're behind the scenes. We've designed a new facility. We have property on the corner of River Street and I-94 Business Loop. Then in the next couple of years, we'll build a brand new facility that will be 3 to 4 times the size of our current facility, and we'll be able to expand our services because we've really outgrown our space. And in that new facility, we can expand our spay and neuter programs and some of other veterinary care programs, as well as our education programs, which not only helps Kalamazoo, but helps surrounding areas because we have funding outside of the county and we have a lot of requests for services outside the county.
Are you raising money for that right now?
Quietly, we are raising money behind the scenes right now. So again, it was called the quiet phase of a capital campaign. Hopefully in the spring or early summer, it will go public. But if anybody's listening and really has a heart for animals, certainly they can contact the office and talk to me personally. But we have some really exciting plans for the future, and we're always willing to share those with people who have an interest in knowing what's our next step.
Aaron Winters, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Aaron Winters is Executive Director of the Kalamazoo Humane Society. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.